You ready for some coffee, honey?
Absolutely.
I'll pour.
Great coffee. I'm Dr. Ron Martinelli.
And I'm Linda Martinelli.
And we are Talking
While Married. Well, it's rare, Ron, that you and I have a disagreement. But we have a disagreement.
Well, I want to get right down to it, Linda.
Okay, so let's get to
you've
it.
You've got an issue with the Johnson & Johnson pharmaceutical lawsuit, and I just want to hear what your issues are.
Well, I want to hear what your issues are. Do you want me to go first?
No, women, ladies first.
Okay. First of all, there's 2,000-some lawsuits about this opioid crisis. And when the pharmaceutical company Purdue was sued, they capitulated and just settled for $275 million.
How many pharmaceutical corporations are being sued, Lynn?
I don't know the answer to that, Ron.
Okay, but Purdue is one of them, right?
Well, they were, but they capitulated.
They're out of the suit.
Right.
Okay.
So the Johnson & Johnson suit, which is in Oklahoma, basically says, and by the way, I'm no expert on this, so I'm telling you from what I hear in the news.
You're just giving me your opinion.
I am.
Right.
That people want to hold them responsible for the amount of deaths that have happened in Oklahoma from opioid usage.
Okay, so opioid overdose deaths.
Yes.
And the plaintiffs in the case want to hold the defendant, in this case Johnson & Johnson, responsible for those deaths.
Yes. I have a big problem with that. And my problem is severalfold. First of all, Johnson & Johnson made a drug that was for the purpose of helping people.
An analgesic drug.
Yes. And that drug was reviewed by the FDA, Food and Drug Administration, and approved for sale. There was no problems with the drug that were
in
their approval of the drug. It was approved for sale. It was approved for salesmen to go into doctor's offices and promote it, and it was approved for use, okay? So they have some responsibility here, but even they, I don't think, should be sued. The issue is that, yes, a number of people have died from opioid use in Oklahoma, but a lot of those people died from misusing the drug and illegally obtaining the drug, not from Johnson & Johnson and not through legal prescription methods. So either from stealing the drug from somebody else, stealing it from their parents, from their friends, from the pharmacy, whatever, or from the drugs coming over the border and being distributed. So you cannot say that those people died from Johnson & Johnson making this drug. And if you do that, if you start this process of demonizing the drug companies and they stop making these drugs, the people that desperately need them for their conditions are not going to be able to have them. I think that people need to be responsible themselves for how they use the drugs, and it's up to their doctor to probably monitor them better as far as if they give them and prescribe these drugs, they need to be watching out for their patients. But what happens is a doctor will prescribe the drug, and then the patient just doesn't come back, and you can't make them come back. People have to be responsible for themselves. There are plenty of warnings inside that drug package.
Time's up, Linda.
Okay.
All right. So, Mrs. Martinelli, have you read the complaint by the plaintiffs?
I did not read the complaint. No, I heard the complaint.
All right. So, there are issues of, you know, when we're talking about death, and death is what I do, when you talk about death, you've got to talk about the proximate cause of death, and then you got to talk about contributory causes of death. So obviously the proximate cause of death is actually what causes the death. And in this case, it would be an overdose of a drug. So you'd have to separate that. So don't forget, and I agree with some of what you're saying, because a lot of times plaintiff attorneys will throw a lot of spaghetti on the wall and see what sticks. And they also take advantage of the optics, both good and bad, when they decide to sue a deep pocket corporation like Johnson & Johnson. So that being said, I think the issues, we need to talk about issues of mitigation and aggravation. So mitigation, what would help, would be exactly what you said. You and I both know, because we have some familiarity with the pharmaceutical industry, we both understand that when you have a prescription drug, and that's what this was, prescription drugs like these types, different types of oxycondones and things like that, you've got a significant amount of testing that goes on for years before the drug is introduced to the public. And of course, as you've correctly stated, the Food and Drug Administration is in charge of that. They are the monitoring agency in the United States for all pharmaceuticals. And so if the FDA approved the drug to be released to the public, that's something that mitigates because they approved it. So they must have seen that if regulated, this drug would be okay. Now, the problem, as you've stated correctly again, is that people misuse the drug. And so one of the biggest problems that we have in the United States are people that become addicted to prescription medications. And some really famous people have become addicted to prescription medications and have acknowledged that and had a problem. You know, Rush Limbaugh is one of the people that I recall had a significant drug problem. And thank God, you know, he got help for that. And he's been, you know, sober from, you know, this drug addiction, which is horrible, for many years now. And I also would give you credit that anybody that would take an illegal drug or that would take a drug illegally. So as you stated, somebody steals a drug. They steal it from a relative. They burglarize a house. They take it at that point. They buy it on the black market. Or they take an illegal drug that has nothing to do with the pharmaceutical that Johnson & Johnson has manufactured and distributed, such as fentanyl. So if they take that type of drug, the only argument that can be made by the plaintiff is got to be that the drug that Johnson & Johnson manufactured was a gateway drug, all right? So the next issue, and this is what I want to speak to, is the salesmanship. And so how did the salesmanship take place with the physicians? Because the salesman, their job is to sell the drug. So how did they sell the drug to the physicians and encourage them to prescribe this particular medication above all others? And I think that's where the investigation goes. Wouldn't you agree that if
they... I don't agree. I don't agree at all.
That's why we're having an argument,
yeah,
right?
because the salesmanship was approved by the FDA. It wasn't just a single thing that was approved. It wasn't just the drug that was approved. It was the salesmanship to the doctor's offices. I don't care if the salesman said that this is the greatest thing since sliced bread. I don't care. It is the doctor's responsibility as a physician to be reading that documentation. And the documentation is clearly there on every package of drugs.
Right. It's referred
as to what the side effects are.
It's referred to as the black box warning on the side of the drug.
And there is no drug, Ron, that is made that has zero side effects, or if there are, I don't know of any, but maybe there are, but that has zero side effects if that drug is abused. Okay. And I really don't care what the drug is. And there are drugs that have serious side effects when not abused. You know, it's like, is the devil worse here or there? You know, because if you really have some sort of a condition that you need a drug, but that drug has serious side effects, you have to make a decision for your life as to what is better.
Okay,
so all drugs have consequences.
Well, are you saying then that it's not the responsibility of the pharmaceutical corporation, even in the salesmanship? You're saying that it's ultimately the physician's responsibility to vet the drug, to read the black box warnings, and to educate, when they are going to prescribe this drug, to educate the patient that comes in and says, hey, I want to talk with you about this drug that I'm going to prescribe, and it's got black box warnings, and you have to worry about this, and you have to watch out for that. Is that what you're saying?
Well, yes, because you can never know what a salesman said in every single doctor's office. There's thousands of salespeople that peddle drugs to doctors. So you can't know the answer to that. The fact is that the material is there and the information is there as to what this drug does. And the fact also is, and can be proven, that in Oklahoma, that many, many of these deaths did not occur by these prescription drugs. They occurred by people, like I said, stealing the drug, using illegal drugs, those types of things.
Well, I think when, okay, so first of all, I don't know enough about the suit, and I'm arguing just on some of what I understand to be some of the legal points, but are we talking about this as a class action suit, or these all individuals? Because you said there's over 2,000
lawsuits. There's 2,000 lawsuits, and they're individual lawsuits. And
okay.
A lot of those are going to, based on this particular lawsuit, which is kind of the bellwether lawsuit, if Johnson & Johnson settles, then the other lawsuits will probably go forward figuring that they'll get a settlement. What this is about, in my mind, is not about anything to protect the public. It's about the greed of attorneys. That's what this is about. And by the way, the people who sued Purdue, what did they do with their $275 million? They built three buildings on their campus. They didn't do anything to stop drug use. They didn't do anything to mitigate the effects of opioids on people. They built three buildings on their campus.
Okay, now, hang on a second, because I think just today there was in one of the news programs, and I don't know, you know, who took the settlement and what they did with it, but one of the entities that ended up prevailing in getting the settlement, and I gather it was some type of university or research that had a research center, they got like $220 million,
yes. Mm-hmm.
And that money was specifically organized or set aside for drug abuse research and recovery.
No, and what they did with that money is built three buildings. And when people complained about what they did with the money,
okay,
they
you know
said,
more than I
they
do.
Said, well, we'll do drug research in those buildings. That's what they said.
Okay.
I think that this is greed on the part of attorneys. And right. I go back to what's his name, the presidential candidate who was the lawyer who sued the company that made a cancer drug for women.
Boy, he's been out of the limelight
yeah.
for a long time. The good-looking guy.
Yeah, and
in the
what
Carolinas
a tragedy! What a tragedy that was, because
yes, very
he
much.
He, because of greed and because of stupidity, he cost a lot of women probably their lives, because that drug company went out of business and stopped making that drug.
Right.
Now, like I said, drugs have consequences when you take drugs. So if you want to sue these people and they stop making these drugs, where does that leave people?
Well, no, I totally agree with you there. And I would say that, you know, if there are 2,000 individual lawsuits and not a class action lawsuit, what generally happens is a vetting process with each individual suit, where they look at the fact pattern of the suit, and again they look at issues of mitigation and aggravation. Ultimately, when it goes before the trier of fact, or the judge, or the jury, whatever system that the attorneys decide on, they're going to look at the people that took the drugs illegally. If they took the drugs illegally, they're going to be dismissed out of that lawsuit because they created that problem. All right, now, wait a minute. The truth of the matter, Lynn, is that the company, and you're so very much aware of this because of the work that I do, that I tell y'all about my cases, but a company can settle, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they did anything wrong. But a lot of times, it's more convenient and it's less costly overall. We're talking not only economically, because it's a bottom line for the shareholders, right, the stockholders, but also, economically, they don't want it to go to the jury and cost a lot of money, because a lot of jurors make their decision based on emotions and not on forensic facts.
Why is that okay with you?
It's not okay with me. I'm just explaining it.
For people to settle or to even have to be sued, because anybody can sue anybody, which I disagree with totally, cost them a lot of money. And that money, you may think Johnson & Johnson has loads of money and they can do whatever, but a lot of their money does go into research, and we need that research, and we need a lot of these drugs to help people along in their lives, or to help cure things or make things more livable for people.
Yeah,
and what we're doing is discouraging that in our drug companies by suing them all the time.
You know what, Lynn? I don't disagree with that. I really don't. And I think that anybody that takes a drug illegally, they steal it, they're not prescribed by it, they buy it on the black market, or they take some other drug because they got addicted to the first drug. So in other words, we're talking about now a different scenario where a citizen that has some sort of medical problem ends up getting prescribed this drug, and then they become addicted to it, and then as a result of that, they start to take other drugs, and as a result of consuming, ingesting illegal drugs, they die from that. You know, to me, that's not a lawsuit that should go forward. However, if, when we were talking about salesmanship, if a salesman misrepresents the drug and misrepresents the harm that the drug can do and encourages the physician to prescribe this drug above all others because the physician is going to get something out of it. Okay, either it's a bonus, it's a commission, it's a vacation, whatever drug companies offer as incentives for physicians.
And there's laws against all of that.
Well, I absolutely agree. And my only point is, if a salesman violates these laws and physicians violate these laws, which are, codified standards of care, medical care, then they deserve to be sued as well. And the company, the jury might find that the company is in some way responsible for that. So what I find is interesting about this discussion between you and me is that you and I very rarely disagree about anything, but it appears that we have a disagreement about this. Can I treat you to a cup of coffee?
I'm Dr. Ron Martinelli.
And I'm Linda Martinelli.
As former law enforcement officers, we know that your life and the lives of those you love and work with can change in an instant when you encounter an active shooter.
Unfortunately, in today's world of uncertainty, encountering an armed active shooter can have deadly consequences. That's why the key to survival is training and preparedness.
And that's why we want to invite our listeners to seriously consider taking our Response to Active Shooter training course.
Violence can happen to you anytime and anywhere and when you least expect it. Having a response and survival plan and engaging it can be the difference between life and death for you or a family member.
Our Response to Active Shooter courses are customized for the corporate, school, church, restaurant, and small business environment at a reasonable budget that fits your needs.
So don't put this life-saving training off because you don't think it will ever happen to you. We call those people victims.
Our Response to Active Shooter instructors are all nationally renowned tactical law enforcement experts who will guide you through the life-saving protocols you'll need to survive an active shooter event.
So be a victor, not a victim. Go to ResponseToActiveShooter.com to learn more today.
Remember, that's all one word, ResponseToActiveShooter.com, and be safe out there.
Well, now that we've kissed and made up while getting a cup of coffee, hey, I want to talk about the whole declassification thing that's going on. I'm pretty excited about it. We got Trump directing Attorney General William Barr. By the way, I love this guy. He's just perfect at this particular time in our American history. And I think he's going to be a very tenacious but very ethical pit bull on behalf of the United States government. And notice I didn't say Trump. I said the United States government, because he's been an attorney general before. He's got a stellar reputation. I personally think that he's the smartest attorney general that I can think of in the last 30, maybe even 40 years. And I've known a lot of them. And now the investigation, the real investigation, begins. So what do you think about that?
Well, I think that everybody's shaken in their boots.
Oh, no doubt.
The hypocrisy always comes out, which it just never ceases to amaze me, because, you know, we had all of these people saying how much they trust Mueller and how the investigation is going to show this and show that, and it showed none of those things. And then when that report came out, they wanted to see the whole report because they were just sure that there must be something in there that was against Trump. And everything needed to be declassified. They even wanted the grand jury investigation to be declassified, which it would not be.
No, it can't be, because right. There is sensitive information. It would actually violate federal law. It would be a felony to disclose it.
Right, but they wanted that. Well, now, when Trump says, fine, let's declassify all the things leading up to this, now they say, oh, how dangerous is that? And you can't do that. And why not? Because you are the people who
colluded
for real to do all of these things. And when you think about, Ron, the things that happened in the Obama administration, going back to Fast and Furious, to Benghazi, to what happened in the Situation Room when Osama bin Laden was in their sights, what happened with there's any number of things that you can end with Hillary's
emails
and all of that. And everything was hidden and everything was covered up. And here's Trump coming out and saying, let's make everything be open. And that's really the last thing that they want, because what they did is going to come to light.
You know, the thing that I really like about this particular president of the United States, and what really stands out, is that he did not come to us as a politician. He came to us as a CEO of a major conglomeration of corporations. He didn't think like a politician. He still doesn't think like a politician. You can tell that he has to be trained to think and act like a politician. A lot of people don't like that. A lot of people don't like the tweets. They don't like the stuff that he does with social media. And I'm one of those people that doesn't like everything he does. But the thing that I like about this guy is that he is transparent. The last president was nothing even approaching transparent, and none of his cabinet were transparent. It was corruption and the deep
dishonesty
at the highest levels. So the people that are shaking in their boots right now, and I am just enjoying being a fly on the wall, are, you know, Comey of the FBI, the former director of the FBI, who I never liked. And then we've got Clapper, and we've got Brennan. You know, the one's the CIA, the other one's NSA.
Both were terrible.
And then we've got the people within the Department of Justice on the FBI side, the Peter Strucks, you know, the people like that. And now the guy that's in the crosshairs is Christopher Steele of the famous Steele dossier, who I think was just recently called or notified that he was going to testify before Congress, and he's already saying, I'm not going to testify.
Yes, he refuses to partake in the investigation.
But we've got to find out who's got the chutzpah and to call these people before Congress when they say, you know what, I am not going to obey this subpoena. Where is the teeth behind that? Okay, now the president can say, I'm not going to go before Congress because he gets executive privilege, and anybody that worked for him can also receive, on behalf of the president, executive privilege. But these other people, I want them to come before Congress, and I want the independent prosecutor that Barr is going to appoint, and he's already appointed these guys. I want these guys digging deep, and I really want to know what started this whole darn thing, this whole FISA warrant. What was the probable cause beyond the FISA warrant, and just who participated in that, and where did that information come from, and follow the money, follow the money, follow the money.
Well, and they're, yeah. And the thing is just the hypocrisy of they want it one way when it's against the president, but they don't want it the same way when it's against them. So I think that we have had to put up with 2 years of watching every single thing about this president be investigated. And now the table is turned. And you know what? That's what happens, is be careful what you do and what you wish for, because things do turn around. And a lot of times in life, what goes around comes around. So you need to be careful what you do. And these people were just gung-ho to get Trump.
Well, it was a coup. You know,
it was a coup.
It was a civil coup. And thank God it got broken up. And I like what the president says. He just doesn't call attention to himself. He says, look, this should never happen again to any sitting president of the United States. And I absolutely agree with him. The next thing that I'm cheering for, and I pray that Bill Barr will fix, and that is the reputation of the Department of Justice, and especially the FBI. He has got to clean house from the top down, because it's a tremendous insult to the thousands of men and women that work in the FBI that do a good job and put their life on the line. And we just saw up there on what we refer to as the seventh floor, which is the administration executive floor of the FBI, there was and continues to be corruption and deep state mentality there. Obstructionist, resist, you know, all of that. Those people have all got to go.
Well, and it's not just there. It's completely in the Congress and the Senate.
Oh, yes.
What are they doing? They're not doing anything except for calling for Trump's impeachment. They are not helping the American people. They don't have an agenda going forward. They just want to impeach the president. And when you have Nancy Pelosi, who's supposed to be a role model, who's supposed to be the leader of Congress, and she's saying despicable things like that the president is hiding something after he has been investigated every which way that you can investigate somebody, and then to say, well, I'm praying for him. I'm hoping that his family has an intervention for him. I mean, give me a break.
Well,
how disrespectful you be?
It's all a backhanded slap. And you know, I'm going to take this particular part of our conversation and go off the railroad tracks for a second and go in another direction that is actually political. But what I want to talk about is taking your cue from Nancy Pelosi. All right, so what have the Democrats accomplished since Trump has been president? What have they accomplished? And then since this last November, so where are we now? We're, 130, 140 days into the new regime of the Democratic majority, and just what the heck have they done? They haven't done a damn thing, and they haven't dealt with immigration. That's a complete shambles and a disgrace, and to me, it is outside of, you know, China and North Korea, which are international security issues, and Russia. What about our internal security of this huge illegal immigration fiasco that we're in the middle of that will, I don't know if it'll ever be resolved.
Exactly. And when it has come out that Obama knew about the DNC being hacked by the Russians and did nothing about it.
And that just came out again.
But they knew. So the Democrats have known this for some time.
Obama knew it before the DNC knew it. He got his warning from the cybersecurity boss that was working for him.
So wouldn't you think that one of the first things that this Congress would do is to make sure that they have the funding to beef up their systems from hackers and stop this from happening in the future. But no, they're too busy talking about Trump, and they're not taking care of the very thing that they were complaining about in all of the last 2 years.
Well, I think it's total BS, because the quote from the cybersecurity boss, who just gave some testimony very recently, he said, "I warned Obama, I warned the State Department, I warned Hillary Clinton, and I got the big, and I developed some programs to counteract what the Russians were doing, and I got the big wave off
right
from the administration," and they said, "Let the next administration deal with it." Well, Jesus, Hillary Clinton, everybody thought in the Obama administration, was going to be the next administration. So if you were that confirmed that Hillary Clinton was going to be the next president, why didn't she take the bull by the horns and run with it and say to that guy, "Yes, I don't want to get hacked. We don't want the United States hacked. We don't want the DNC hacked by the Russians. We don't want them interfering and meddling with our elections. Do everything right now. I empower you to do everything that you possibly can, pull out all the stops and stop the Russians in their tracks." But that's not what happened.
So any thinking American has to look at this and say, it wasn't President Trump doing any of
this. Not a bit.
It was the Democrats doing
right.
all of it. And they still are not doing a thing about it.
Well, let's go back to Nancy Pelosi and Schumer, but especially crazy Nancy. And so what's the next big thing that the Democrats and the Republicans have talked about with respect to working in a bipartisan, you know, relationship to fix our
infrastructure? Right.
Absolutely. And so what does she do? She knows she's going to have a meeting with the President of the United States. That doesn't happen very often. And he's all ready for a meeting, and he is planning on, okay, let's get down and roll up our sleeves, and let's deal with infrastructure. Let's do something bipartisan for the American people. What does she do that very morning? She has a press conference, and then I don't remember if it was just the press conference.
She had
speaking.
An impeachment meeting, too.
And what does she do? What does she do?
She says that
he's
Trump
covering
is
up.
Covering up. Right?
Covering up. And insults him, and basically calls him a liar, and calls him in effect, a corrupt president of the United
yes.
States that is covering up things a la Richard Nixon. And then she feels that, okay, I'm just going to take my motorcade and drive over from the Senate chambers, and which is basically across the street, and I'm going to go to the White House, or actually the Capitol building, wherever the hell they met. I think it was in the White House.
Yes, in the White House.
Okay, so a couple of blocks away, and everything's going to be hunky-dory with the president of the United States. Oh, my God. What did she expect was going to happen? Of course he's going to walk out of that meeting.
Well, no, she's absolutely set him up.
Well, of course she did.
But I would, actually, I would do what he did as well. I would walk out as well. And then her meeting after that, her address to the nation was absolutely one of the most despicable addresses that I have ever heard. Basically calling him mentally ill and saying, you know, that he wasn't prepared, and that this was just an excuse because he wasn't prepared and didn't know what to do about how to fund this infrastructure. No, Nancy, your big mouth got you in trouble, and you need to be quiet, and you need to be respectful of the president and get things done. This is 100,000% your fault.
Well, it's exactly right. And the thing is that is a betrayal to everybody in the United States. I don't care if you're Republican, Democrat, Independent, I don't care what the heck you are. We need to drive on roads. We need to be able to cross bridges. We need to, you know, we need to be able to function. We need to have power grids. We need to have dams. We need to have water flow. We need to have flood mitigation. There's so many different things that are part of the infrastructure of the United States that are not getting done when they had the perfect opportunity to be polite and respectful to the President of the United States, but they're scared of him.
They can't be. They don't know how to be.
Even if it's bipartisan, this is the thing that really bothers me, even if it's bipartisan, they don't want to give him any credit whatsoever for doing anything positive with the United States.
No.
Nothing.
No, they would rather see the United States suffer than give him what they call a win. Now, in contrast, Ron, President Trump, and this is what I admire about him, he just goes forward. He just keeps trucking along and going forward. What did he do? He went to Japan, and he made agreements with Japan, first of all, on buying beef again from the United States,
right,
which is a big deal. Since 2000, they've not been buying beef from the United States.
You know, you're right, and he gets along pretty good with Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. And, you know, he's the first leader of a country to meet with Emperor Naruhito, who was just enthroned just this last month. So how cool is that? And boy, I'll tell you what, making that beef deal with Japan is really going to help the beef industry, especially in our state of Texas and next door to us in Oklahoma.
And that's not the only deal that he made. But you haven't heard this on the news because they don't talk about it.
No, they're talking about his comments about North Korea,
okay,
when North Korea was shooting off the short-range missiles.
Let's talk about that.
Yeah.
He's got a plan, and he's pretty darn smart. So he sold Japan some huge number, over 100 F-135s.
F-35s. Yeah, the new strike
okay,
fighter.
So that they will have the largest force of F-35s
in the world.
Okay, what does that say to North Korea? So he's saying one thing out of his mouth about Kim Jong-un, but on the other hand, he is building up Japan and the people that would normally fear North Korea. So Un sees this and he says, uh-oh, you know. So Trump is acting very strategically in everything that he does. He did some good deals over there. And he's also done, you know, I think that we talked about that with Mexico, he opened up the steel market again, took the tariffs off. So again, another big deal. He just keeps moving forward
and
getting things done day in and day out.
And he worked out such a good deal with the auto industry that they are taking one of their plants that they were going to build in Mexico and they're going to build it here in the United States.
And that's
going to create a couple of thousand more jobs with tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars staying in the United States instead of going into Mexico. You know, the one thing that you've said that I really like about this president is he's tenacious. He doesn't let this stuff hit him. He's got, you know, blinders on with regards to all of the insults and all of these things that happen. And he's just focused like a laser beam on moving forward. How about our last cup of coffee?
The goal is to deliver a message of truth, inspiration, and hope to the world, to unite people from all backgrounds and beliefs in an effort to advance humanity. News blogs, informative podcasts, and entertaining videos. It's AmericaOutloud.com, where the conversation never ends. With 24/7 streaming on our free apps on both Android and Apple. Welcome to the new era in communications, America Out Loud Talk Radio.
You know, when we get so caught up in the politics and the elections in the United States, we completely forget about what's going on in the European Union and Great Britain. And I'm telling you what, there's rockets being fired back and forth. Things are getting kind of nasty over there. And I don't care what country you're in, it just seems to be a fight between nationalists and globalists. What do you think about that?
Well, I think that the elections that we just had really boosted the nationalists. And they're out for their countries instead of this whole global...
Yeah, the United Nations and globalism.
Yeah, that didn't work so well for anybody.
Well, you know what's going on here in the United States is that we are being, I think, assaulted by people that are globalists. And, you know, the people that are really pushing this stuff, besides the Europeans, are, you know, one of my favorite characters. Like, I always refer to him, George Soros, as the man behind the curtain.
Yeah.
You know, the currency manipulators, for God's sakes. And they would like nothing better than to see the United States sort of auger in with socialism, so guys like Merkel could buy low and sell high with regards to currency. I think that's what it's all about for that guy. I mean, he is just, he's incredible, you know, funding all these Marxist revolutionary movements, and he is a big part of the whole collusion thing against President Trump and the United States itself. He does everything he can to put this country down. But I don't want to talk about the U.S. I'm more interested in discussing this whole issue about Brexit and Great Britain and what's going on in France and what's going on in Germany and Italy. And I just wanted to hear your thoughts, because we do so much traveling to Europe.
Well, I mean, so when we've traveled to Europe more recently, what we saw is that the people in Europe really like Trump. And surprisingly, so we were surprised, because you don't hear that on our news.
Oh, no, you wouldn't.
Yeah, you hear a lot of that everybody doesn't like him, but they actually do. And the direction in the countries that were going towards democracy and towards capitalism were being much more successful. And I think that the other countries are seeing that. They tried this globalism, and they tried lifting up those that didn't want to do anything, and they tried the whole socialist type of thing, and it's not working for them.
And you know, the people in, or the countries in Europe that don't do well because they're more, you know, lazier, and some of them are socialist. I mean, let me give you a great example, because we visited Greece a couple of years ago. Look at what the heck's going on in Greece. Their entire economy is in the toilet. And you know what? I just got the numbers on the GDP in the European Union, which is what they refer to as the EU. And the GDP growth this past year, 2018, was only 1.3 and remains at 1.3. And what are we? We're at like 3.3, 3.4 GDP. And we're looking at a sustained constant growth of that nature in our GDP in the United States. We're like exactly three times higher than their GDP. And look at our employment is through the roof, and they have got huge unemployment problems.
Well,
there,
they got themselves into trouble, Ron, by all of their entitlements. And open borders. And anybody in those European countries will tell you that. Maybe the politicians won't tell you that, but anybody who lives there will tell you that. They don't like it. And the countries who have stayed away from it have been quite successful. And Austria is one of those countries.
Switzerland is another one of those countries.
So they feel that they've gotten themselves in a lot of trouble, like I said, with the entitlements. And we ought to take a lesson from that. But, you know, I want to switch gears a little bit, because I want to talk about another overseas place. And really another Trump accomplishment, where the DHS just inked a deal with Guatemala, who is has sent up 1% of their population has come up and come over our border, and another 40% wants to do so.
Can you imagine 40% of Guatemalans living in the United States? That would be catastrophic.
Well, what our DHS under Trump did is they made a deal with Guatemala to combat that crisis and to do what they can to keep people in their own country. So, you know, I think that these are things that we're not hearing in the news. And again, it's just another thing where Trump is acting and getting things done and getting things done.
Well, you got to be proactive with stuff like that, because, and we have talked about that, and you wrote a great article called Calizuela, and what you pointed out and what I've discussed as well, because you and I are of the same mindset, is that we want to invite people internationally to come and live and work and thrive in the United States. But we cannot be the magnet, so to speak, for all of the uneducated, low-skilled, impoverished, language-deficient people. We just can't do that. And when people say, well, wait a minute, look at the Statue of Liberty and look at the inscription on the, give us your tired, you're poor, you're this, you're that. You know what? That was 100 years ago when we needed low source labor. Okay, we had factories. That was the industrial era of the United States. We needed factories. We had a thriving agricultural thing. We needed basically low-skilled laborers to do that. The United States, the paradigm has completely changed. And those people are doomed to nothing but poverty and entitlement if they come here. There has to be a stop of
that.
Well,
there are lots of countries who have immigration done by merit, and even Mexico is one of them. Yes. Australia is another one.
Yes.
So there's nothing wrong with that. And it's not that every single person has to be by merit, but we need to change this whole paradigm of how people are coming into our country.
Well, the vast majority are not here because of merit. Okay,
they're
here
not.
Because they snuck in illegally,
or
they overstayed their visas,
or they're from a family member.
That's exactly right, or they got involved in the lottery system, and that is the vast majority. The vast majority of immigrants that come into the United States are from those groups, not the ones that have gone through the proper vetting process. You know, they are going through the education, the civics training, all of that, and they have something to bring to the table. Language skills, they're bonded, they have money, they have skills, professional skills. They're not those types of people. That's not the majority, and that is a huge mistake. And look at what has happened to Europe, especially France, and even Italy,
and
because
England
of it,
as
and
well.
England
sure.
as well.
Sure, but I want to point out, because the border is such a big issue, a couple things on the border. And one is that the border wall just started being built on private property by the private money collected by the paraplegic, I think he's a Marine, right?
Right.
Yeah.
And what a great
and,
idea.
Yeah.
We had thought about that idea and he ran
yeah.
with it. So
and then,
good
of course,
for him.
Of course, a court stepped in and told him he had to stop, or at least the city did. And he says that that's baloney, and so now they're going to court. Everything seems to end up the court is making the decisions about everything. But the other thing that I want to talk about on this is one of the things that I've heard lately that really is disturbing to me is a lot of the Democrats have been saying talking about the 5 or 6 youth that have died in the custody of our Border Patrol. And you know what you hear is so disingenuous, because first of all, these are people that made an incredible journey and they were ill before they ever hit the border.
Right.
And
they're unvaccinated, ill,
they were already sick.
There and was, weak and frail, yes. And weak because of it.
There was nothing that our people did wrong that caused the death of these people. But what I want to point out, because nobody else points it out, and you definitely don't hear it on the news, people need to understand how many children that these Border Patrol officers risk their lives to save on a daily basis. And, you know, I'm going to tell you about a couple of them, because I think it's good news stories, and I think that people need to understand that these Border Patrol agents are heroes. They rescue children every day.
Yeah, I think that's a good topic of discussion.
Yeah, there are a lot of people that are crossing that Rio Grande River, and
which can be treacherous.
They don't understand the swiftness of the water,
exactly.
or the depth of the water.
Especially this time of year.
And what happens is they rescue people. They have just this fiscal year have saved in that river over 2,000 migrants.
That is amazing. And a lot of these people can't swim.
Yes.
And so they take like a tube or some type of flotation device and they go out into this river. And, you know, us living in Texas, we're pretty darn familiar with the Rio Grande River. And it is. It can be treacherous.
It can be swift moving water. And because we have a lot of rainstorms in Texas and they come you know, pretty frequently.
And all of a sudden.
Yeah, it can come all of a sudden. And by the way, you know, I said over 2,000. It's almost 3,000 that they've saved just since the beginning of this year. Now, I want to tell you, there are kids that are being pulled across that river by their parents. And a lot of those parents, they, for whatever reason, they get in trouble. They let go of their child. There are numerous occasions when these officers jump off their boat, risk their own lives, jump in the water, and save these children. And it's story after story after story. There's a six-year-old that was saved by an agent that was, you know, happened to be patrolling in the area, and they were coming across the river on one of those makeshift rafts, and which tipped over and dumped everybody in the river, and the six-year-old got swept away, and the officer jumped in and he saved the boy. There's an airboat that rescued three children that were swept away in the current. There's just story after story. There's another child that was suffering from seizures and convulsions. Did they cause that? No. This is something that he already had.
You know, this is such a great topic that you're bringing up right now, because you know me, I'm all about law enforcement, and I follow all these law enforcement stories. I got to tell you, Lynn, this is the first time that I've heard of this.
Well, let's talk about this little girl with the seizures. Was 2 years old and having convulsions and seizures, and they rushed her to a medical facility in Eagle Pass, Texas, and you know, they got her taken care of. These are the stories that happen every single day that we don't hear about. There's another agent that was chasing down human smugglers, and they find a three-year-old child that those smugglers abandon as they're fleeing, and they save that child. Okay, these are everyday stories. These are not the exception. So when these people in our Congress talk about how horrible it is that these six children died in our custody, like I said, every single one of them documented was ill before they ever got into our custody, and they died like pretty immediately after being in custody, so they were already that way. But they don't talk about the agents that jumps in the river and saves a drowning seven-year-old boy.
And you know, the people can't imagine the logistical nightmare and the stressors and the challenges that Customs and Border Patrol has. You and I see it firsthand. We just saw it a couple of weeks ago, you know, coming back from Texas to California. We made a stop. We talked about it in Deming, New
yes.
Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, there are serious challenges. And you can't imagine going in one of these detention centers, which have to be made makeshift because nobody was prepared to take on, you know, tens of thousands and now hundreds of thousands of people that come across in just a couple of months into the United States. We just don't have these facilities. And so we're trying to, you know, set up these detention facilities and the logistics of the food and the water and bunking and taking care of these kids and hospitalization and repatriation of kids with families that, you know, parents abandoned them. This is an incredible, I would call it a Herculean challenge. And we're doing the very best job we can. But who created the problem? Is Congress. It is absolutely disgraceful. And these people, these older Pelosis and these Schumers and these Naders and all of these people that are getting older, they are going to retire being multi-millionaires that don't give a damn about what is happening in this country. And they will be basically forgotten with the horrible legacy that they've left and dire straits that they've left the United States of America in. They should never be forgiven, and they should never be forgotten. I am so angry about these people.
Well, I'm angry about all of them.
And that Republicans
that sat
on their hands
yes.
when they had opportunities,
yes.
when Trump first came in, and they had major opportunities when we held the majority in the Congress,
yes.
And were hanging on to the Senate, and they didn't do one single thing. And I can't forgive that either.
No, shame on all of them. But when you have an Ocasio-Cortez, and you have a Gillibrand, and you have a
And that turncoat Republican, for God's sakes, what's his name that looks like he's going to vote Democrat?
Amash, I think it is.
Amash.
Yeah. But when you have these, especially, it almost seems like the women are the ones that are complaining more about the six deaths. What about the 2,700 since the beginning of the year that they have saved? How dare you not mention that? And call these men absolute heroes for doing it.
And you know what? There's your next article for America Out Loud. I tell you, I hadn't even heard of that. And, I mean, that's an amazing story that you're discussing. We can't do enough to support our men and women that protect our border. You know, we run into Border Patrol guys all the time.
Yeah.
And they're just the nicest, nicest people. And, you know, on many different levels. And it's just absolutely incredible that they take the bad rap that they do, the tremendous sacrifices they make.
When the people that are against the immigration are always referred to as racist, I have to say that most of the Border Patrol that we have ever met
are people of color,
people.
Men and women.
Yes.
Men and women of color.
They are from Mexico. They're from these other
countries. All these other countries,
yeah.
Right.
So no, there's no racism involved here. They are doing the best job they can, and God bless them.
And you know, none of them were trained to do this either. That is not what they were trained for. They were trained for security and a law enforcement mission, and now all of a sudden they're bouncing to humanitarian missions, which is a totally different paradigm. They don't have the resource, they don't have the funding, they don't have the manpower, and they work tirelessly day and night protecting this country. Well, I'll tell you what, speaking of tiredness, I'm kind of tired. Why don't we hit the sack?
Okay, we'll join the Desi Dog.
She's already out cold.